Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Norm Roblad, founder of Digestive Health Institute, author of the Fast Tracked Digestion book series, creator of the Fast Tracked Diet mobile app. Today, I'd like to talk about how you can restore your gut microbiota to a more healthy balance by identifying and addressing different forms of gut dysbiosis. So let's get started. I'll share my slide deck with you. Okay. Well, first of all, what is gut dysbiosis? Gut dysbiosis is a negative shift in the microbial communities within the small or the large intestine, resulting in either health conditions or symptoms. Generally speaking, it's an imbalance of gut microbes compared to healthy individuals, of course, recognizing that everyone has a unique microbiota. So what health conditions are linked to dysbiosis? Well, there are many, and some would argue that almost all health issues begin in the gut. But some prominent ones are IBS, GERD, chronic fatigue syndrome, interstitial cystitis, rosacea, inflammatory bowel disease, fibromyalgia, fatty liver disease, Parkinson's, asthma, autoimmune issues, obesity, epilepsy, and many others. Though dysbiosis is a factor in a variety of health conditions, many of the studies that I cite in this presentation have been done in IBS patients. And the reason is there's a lot of studies to pick from. But I do reference a couple of others as well. Now let's talk about the types of dysbiosis that are responsible for these health conditions. There are basically four types of dysbiosis. In the small intestine, we have SIBO, for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this one. But there's also SIFO, for small intestinal fungal overgrowth. In the large intestine, we have LIBO, which stands for large intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and IMO, for intestinal methanogen overgrowth. Each type of dysbiosis involves a unique imbalance within our microbial communities. It's important to understand which form of dysbiosis you may have because the treatment options can vary. Now, let's take a closer look at each form of dysbiosis. For one, how prevalent is each one? And number two, what are the significant microbiological shifts in each case? For SIBO, about 50 to 75% of people with IBS symptoms have SIBO. The types of bacteria in SIBO include small intestinal inhabitants, such as Streptococcus and Villanella, as well as bacteria migrating from the large intestine. And some of those include E. coli and Klebsiella, Proteus, Bacteroides, Prevotella, Clostridia, and Fusobacteria. In the case of SIFO, about 25% of patients with unexplained GI symptoms, such as belching, bloating, indigestion, nausea, diarrhea, and gas, have SIFO. Now, we normally have small numbers of fungi in our gut, but too many in the small intestine may be a problem. Species of fungi in SIFO are mostly Candida albicans, but they may include other fungal strains as well, and I've listed a few here. In the case of LIBO, while the exact percentage of LIBO in IBS patients is unknown, initial studies show that IBS patients produce more acid in the early large bowel, which is indicative of LIBO. What about bacterial types in LIBO? Well, IBS patients have much higher levels of Firmicutes type of bacteria over Bacteroides. We'll talk a little bit about those later. But healthy controls have the opposite. And this is important, and we'll be talking more about this as we go on. In the case of IMO, we're basically talking about constipation-predominant IBS, which represents approximately one half of IBS patients, or 5 to 10% of the population. IMO used to be part of a SIBO diagnosis, but people that were producing high levels of methane. Since these methanogens are not bacteria, intestinal methanogen overgrowth has been renamed as IMO. Most IMO involves an overgrowth of Methanobrevibacter smithii, and mostly in the large intestine. But M. smithii has also been recovered in the small intestine. Now, let's talk about how to determine if you have one or more of these conditions. SIBO is diagnosed using the lactulose or glucose hydrogen breath test. And the definition of a positive test is greater than 20 parts per million of hydrogen over the baseline sample. I usually recommend lactulose as the test sugar because it can detect SIBO throughout the entire small intestine. For SIFO, there is no standard test at this point. The only doctor I know of offhand that does this is Dr. Satish Rao, a gastroenterologist at the medical school or the Medical College of Georgia. He uses an endoscope to sample and culture fungi from the small intestine of people with GI symptoms. And while this is a little bit of an invasive test, if somebody's really struggling and they can't get to the bottom of it, it might be worth it. Dr. Rao considers a positive test as having greater than 10 to the 3 or 1,000 fungal cells per mil. LIBO, like SIFO, there is no standard test for LIBO, but it may be possible to get tested for this at, say, a teaching hospital such as Johns Hopkins, where they have access to smart pill technology that can measure changes in intestinal pH, because that's how the LIBO connection was initially made. And in one of these slides, I've linked to a couple of those studies. But now, while it's not perfect, another possible alternative way is to get comprehensive stool testing. I routinely analyze the results from my clients looking at the numbers of different bacterial species and the ratio of the major groupings, some of which may be indicative of LIBO. For IMO, IMO is also diagnosed using the lactulose or glucose breath test, but in this case, they're looking for methane gas. This can be done in conjunction with a SIBO breath test. High levels of methane at any point in the test, and the general cutoff is greater than 10 parts per million, indicates an overgrowth of methanogens. As you can see, some forms of dysbiosis are challenging to diagnose, but the good news is there are definitive actions you can take to impact all forms of dysbiosis. Now, what about treatments? Each form of dysbiosis will respond differently to various treatments, but they have one thing in common. They are all fed by carbohydrates ultimately. SIBO and LIBO bacteria feed on a wide range of carbohydrates, from certain simple sugars to complex fibers and starches, while SIFO or fungi feed more on simple sugars. IMO or methanogens, they use hydrogen for fuel, but that hydrogen comes from bacteria that are fermenting mostly carbohydrates. This is why I always recommend dietary and behavioral intervention first, because this is critical for addressing all forms of dysbiosis, while at the same time focusing heavily on identifying and addressing one of the many potential underlying or contributing causes, and these would be specific to your particular case. But keep in mind, 30 grams of unabsorbed carbohydrates allow bacteria to produce 10 liters of gas. So you can imagine 10 liters of gas in your small or large intestine. And of course, this gas can be converted to methane as well. So we'll come back to diet and behaviors and causes later. But for now, let's take a look at other treatment options for each type of dysbiosis, just to have a complete discussion here. For SIBO, herbal protocols for SIBO include the one from Johns Hopkins using herbal combinations, including oil of oregano and berberine. Also, allicin from garlic has strong antimicrobial properties and is used by many practitioners, but there is a distinct lack of published studies on this. So, you know, those treatments come with a little bit of a grain of salt. Pharmaceutical antibiotics for SIBO include rifaximin, as well as some systemic antibiotics such as ciprofloxacin, metronidazole, and others. Rifaximin is popular because it's a broad-spectrum antibiotic, meaning it inhibits a wide range of strains, and it's also not absorbed into the systemic circulation, so it's less toxic. And also it's improved, it's approved by the FDA for IBS-D, a SIBO-related condition. Other antibiotics are prescribed for various reasons or if rifaximin doesn't work. For SIFO, pharmaceutical antifungals are most commonly recommended, including fluconazole that's recommended by Dr. Rao. Nystatin is also a possibility. And one good thing about nystatin is it's not systemically absorbed. Again, better in terms of less toxicity. But there is still a question out there about how well the drug survives stomach acid. And I offhand don't know a definitive answer to that. Also, some data in infants suggests that the probiotic Saccharomyces boulardii or Lactobacillus rhamnosus strain GG might also be effective. There are also herbal treatments, which include castor oil and caprylic acid, as well as olive leaf extract, berberine, N-acetylcysteine, or NAC. And there's some thought they may help with biofilms. But the data supporting these herbal treatments are pretty limited. For LIBO, since LIBO is a new phenomenon, there are more questions than answers about antibiotic use. And by the way, rifaximin won't be helpful for this overgrowth in the large intestine because it requires bile for activity, and bile is reabsorbed by the end of the small intestine. But there are other antibiotics, including neomycin, cipro, metronidazole, that may be used. Again, I'm not advocating antibiotics, at least as a first line of treatment, but just to be complete, I wanted to put some of those out there. Now, what about IMO? First of all, it's really important if you have an overgrowth of methanogens and a lot of methane is to check any medications you're taking for side effects, because many medicines cause constipation and some supplements too. The probiotic Lactobacillus reuterii may be helpful. There's a couple of published studies on that. For antibiotics, the top choice is a combination of rifaximin and neomycin for inhibiting these methanogens. But also herbals such as allicin, oregano, and neem may help. Again, these herbs have not been proven for their efficacy in specific studies. There's also been some, got ahead of myself here. Yeah, there's also been some positive reviews for caprylic acid. But again, there's just not a lot of work has been done on this. Okay, before going into dietary interventions for each type of dysbiosis, let me take a step back and talk about the types of microbes in our gut. This may come in handy when we talk about how dietary interventions work. Well, we have 400 to 1,000 different species of microbes in our gut, so it's pretty diverse. Most of these are bacteria, and all of them belong to one of these groupings of microbes called phyla. Even though our microbiota belong to 8 different phyla, up to 90% of them belong to only 2 phyla, either Firmicutes or Bacteroidetes. That's why those take up most of the pie chart here. Let me just give you some examples of each of these groupings. And I am heavyweighting the Firmicutes and Bacteroidetes a bit since they are just make up such a large percentage by the numbers of the microbes in our gut. Firmicutes include bacteria such as Clostridia, For example, C. butyricum, Faecalibacterium prausnitzii is a Clostridium organism. Rosaburia species, as well as Ruminococcus, such as Ruminococcus turcas and Ruminococcus bromii. Both of those two bacteria come up time and time again in studies that look at the microbes of IBS patients. What about Bacteroidetes? Well, they include Bacteroides fragilis, Bacteroides theta iota omicron, one of the most nutritionally versatile bacteria on the planet. Odorybacter is a Bacteroidetes, and Prevotella, which is prominent on plant-based diets. Regarding the other six phyla, representing approximately 10% of our microbes, I'll just touch upon each one briefly. Actinobacteria, they include the well-known group of bifidobacteria species. Proteobacteria include E. coli, Klebsiella, Pseudomonas, but also sulfate-reducing bacteria that produce hydrogen sulfide. Archaea include Methani brevibacter smithii, as I mentioned, which is a methane producer. Fusobacteria include genera of Fusobacterium, like Fusobacterium nucleatum. And having a large number of Fusobacteria has been one of the markers that's been identified in colorectal cancer, just to keep that in mind. All of us have it, so it's normal to have some, but they do find high levels with colon cancer. Verrucomicrobia is an interesting one. An example would be Commensa mucinophila, lives on the mucus lining, and it feeds on mucus as a sole carbon and energy source and can cross-feed other microbes because it has kind of that lock and key that can break down the mucus. And of course, there's fungi, and we talked about Candida albicans. All right. There's a general consensus that low-carb diets only improve the symptoms of dysbiosis. But I would argue that in the case of IBS, at least, right, that's where some of this research comes from, there are distinct physical changes caused by dysbiosis. And by the way, this has been found in obesity and epilepsy studies as well. And these changes, they're corrected with very low-carbohydrate diets. So let me talk about some of these physical changes, right? We're not talking about symptoms. We're talking about physical things that change that may underlie the symptoms in IBS patients relative to healthy controls. First of all, there's too much intestinal gas in general, which is consistent with symptoms of bloating, distension, cramps, pain, flatulence, and reflux. And keep in mind, excess hydrogen and hydrogen sulfide has been linked to diarrhea, whereas too much methane has been linked to constipation. Also, the levels of short-chain fatty acids, right, like butyrate and propionate and so forth that are produced by bacteria, they're too high. And it's almost certainly indicative of an overgrowth of bacteria. Also, there's significantly more acid in the early part of the large intestine. And there's a couple of studies, I know I've got a link in here somewhere for those, where they found this out for IBS patients, much more acidic in the early part of the large bowel, indicative of an overgrowth in that region. And that's where I came up with the term LIBO from those two studies. Also, there are too many of these Firmicutes bacteria over Bacteroidetes. So it's common to see this reported out in gut testing as a ratio of Firmicutes to Bacteroidetes. And since these are so make up so much of the microbes in our gut, the ratio of this matters. Okay, so most of the studies I looked at, by the way, linked these physical changes with symptoms. Now, let's examine what happens to these physical changes when people go on diets that limit fermentable carbohydrates. First of all, they do improve the symptoms. They reduce gases, especially hydrogen, although we need better, higher quality studies for methane and hydrogen sulfide. They reduce short-chain fatty acids. at least in three of the four studies that I looked at. You know, these short-chain fatty acids are a little bit challenging to measure because they tend to measure them mostly in a stool sample, although there was one that looked at short-chain fatty acids in SIBO and found like a sevenfold increase. Also, short-chain fatty acids are being absorbed at the same time they're being used by other microbes. So I understand this smart pill technology that will measure these more real-time in the future. Also, they should reduce the acid in the colon, right? That's the sign of LIBO. And the reason I say that is because there are studies, lactulose and fiber studies in particular, that show that when you add more fermentable material, that the acidity increases in the colon. So it makes sense that a low-carb diet, less fuel, should reduce this. And they low-carb diets also reduce this Firmicutes to Bacteroidetes ratio. And again, shown in IBS studies, shown in obesity studies, and it's shown in epilepsy studies. And this is a link to a lecture I gave out in Seattle last spring, SIBOCon 2019, where I really dug into some of these topics in more detail. If you click on this link, I believe there's a YouTube video up where you can watch that entire lecture. Okay, let's talk a little bit just to get a lay of the landscape. There's a lot of different diets that limit fermentable carbohydrates in one form or another and to a different extent. And this is a comparison relating to the relative amount of fermentable carbohydrates they contain. People with dysbiosis who suffer with a wide variety of functional GI disorders, such as IBS and GERD, often don't tolerate as much fermentable material in their diet. At one end of the spectrum, we have much more available fermentable carbohydrates that bacteria and even fungi can use, and the archaea can use hydrogen produced from bacteria fermenting the carbs. So these are like a high fiber, high prebiotic, plant-based diet. Now, I'm not saying there aren't plenty of people that can be on this type of diet and be perfectly fine and have minimal symptoms and be everything's great. But I'm just saying there is more available carbohydrate there. So if you do have a lot of gas or bloating or a number of these functional GI conditions, I think that's one place you need to look. Are you able to tolerate as much fermentable material as somebody else may be able to? Okay. The other end of the spectrum, by the way, the absolute lowest fermentable carb diet is fasting, and introducing some of that into your life if you have the fat to support it is a good idea. There's also the carnivore diet. The elemental diet, even though it's a high carb diet, the carbohydrates are in the form of glucose, which is quickly absorbed, and so it tends to be less fermentable material. And so forth. And the keto diet is in the middle, and the low-carb diet, FODMAP diet, because FODMAP diet, even though it does restrict these fermentable oligodiene monosaccharides and polyols, it doesn't limit resistant starch or fibers. So there's a little bit more fermentable material. The reason I included the fast-track diet here as kind of a continuum is because it does span the spectrum. It's really a tool to quantitatively measure and limit basically five groups of fermentable carbohydrates that we'll be talking about in any food. It accomplishes this using what I call the fermentation potential calculation, or FP. A lot of people refer to it that way. And you can think of it as symptom potential. So even a vegetarian or somebody on a high-carb diet, they can look at the vegetables and starches and other foods they're consuming with the FP calculation, which gives a readout in grams of fermentable material per serving, in other words, FP points per serving. And so they can make different choices to get their symptoms under control. By the way, towards the end, I am going to talk a little bit more about plant-based diets and some things people can do. And again, just to keep in mind, when you think about fermentable material, 30 grams, just over an ounce, allows bacteria to produce 10 liters of hydrogen gas. Okay, I call this slide carbohydrate no-brainers. There are five basic types of fermentable carbohydrates, but I broke them down into two groups because the first group is what I call no-brainers. These carbohydrate types include fructose and polymers of fructose, lactose, and carbohydrate-related sugar alcohols. By the way, excluding erythritol, which is one non-fermentable sugar alcohol, and it's gut-friendly and it's a natural sweetener as well. But there's very clear evidence that many people are quite intolerant to these. Over half of the world's population has some level of intolerance to fructose and lactose. And people are intolerant to too many sugar alcohols since they're digested very poorly, but like these carbohydrates, they're very highly fermentable. And again, except erythritol. So unabsorbed carbohydrates and sugar alcohols other than erythritol have the potential to overfeed gut bacteria, leading to all of these problems that we've been discussing. And since most people and doctors and practitioners don't have an issue with cutting back on these, I don't really want to spend more time on them. Now, there is more controversy about carbohydrate intolerance when it comes to fibers, and there's many, many different types of fibers, and resistant starch. But keep in mind, they are fermentable and they're not digested. All right, so using some caution with these, I think makes sense for people with dysbiosis. And this is consistent with the NICE guidelines. I've got some links in here. You can read more about these. So based on Cochrane Reviews, it's a British group, as well as the Textbook of Primary and Acute Care Medicine. In both of these organizations, textbook and this organization, the same group of carbohydrate types and sugar alcohols targeted by the fast-track diet have been linked to excessive intestinal gases and symptoms. There's also a link to a study by Professor John Hunter in 2005 that he found out just removing fiber from the diet was literally as effective for gas and IBS symptoms as the powerful antibiotic metronidazole. And this 2017 study showed that resistant starch actually increases this Firmicutes bacteroidetes ratio, right? What we don't have, what they find in IBS and obesity and epilepsy patients versus healthy controls, resistant starch will drive that. And it also stimulates the growth of one particular type of Firmicutes bacteria called Ruminococcus. It comes up time and time again as a hallmark of these IBS studies. So the fast-track diet, that's one of the reasons, these are some of the reasons that the fast-track diet imposes limits on both fiber and resistant starch. Also here, there's a link to a prominent review on fiber, looking at fiber for functional GI issues, written by a gastroenterologist named William Che in 2013. And they were looking at how fiber might be able to help people with functional GI issues. But I'll draw your attention to the last sentence in the abstract, that says, even when used judiciously, fiber can exacerbate abdominal distension, flatulence, constipation, and diarrhea. And that's in a review that's trying to get to the possible benefits of fiber. So, but I mean, there is that question out there, is it healthy to limit fiber? You know, don't we need it? Don't our microbes need it? A lot of people think that. But the daily recommendations for fiber, and it's somewhere around 25 to 35 grams per day, while most people, at least in the US, only consume about 14 grams a day. It's not really well supported. There's no randomly controlled trials or Cochrane evidence to support this recommendation. Fiber and resistant starch are not essential nutrients. And also, we do get fiber and other fermentable carbohydrates from green leafy veggies, as well as from animal fibers, including oligosaccharides, from dairy and collagen, chondroitin, from ligaments, tendons, and bones, and skin and cartilage. So it's a couple of links here to some blog articles I wrote, The Dark Side of Fiber, Resistant Starch, Friend or Foe. You can read about more there. And also, again, you might check out that SIBOCON lecture linked in one of the above slides, because I really get into these two at a deeper level. All right, so let's talk about dietary recommendations for each type of dysbiosis. And a lot of these diets are going to look pretty similar. And I basically put in notation, you know, if it's consistent with the fast track diet or not. Because I do believe that these three things that the fast track diet accomplishes, limiting fermented material, improving digestion and absorption, working on underlying causes, are really important for all of these forms of dysbiosis. But there are a few individual differences, and we'll talk about those. So for SIBO, I recommend starting out by imposing strict limits on all fermentable carbohydrate types, including lactose, fructose, sugar alcohols, fiber, and resistant starch. That's the fast track diet. To reduce the overall microbe counts, but also to correct the underlying changes we talked about, gases, short chain fatty acids, et cetera, and to resolve the symptoms. In terms of these FP points, I recommend an initial limit of about 15 points a day, at least until you get symptoms under control, unless you're a much larger person and perhaps you could be a little higher then. And after your symptoms are under control, you can certainly experiment with increasing the points. Now, some argue that we don't need to limit fiber and resistant starch for SIBO because complex carbs are thought to be fermented mostly in the large intestine. But this hasn't been shown in all studies. Some show that there is fermentation of fiber going on in the small intestine. And then when you think of SIBO, remember that slide we talked about what organisms were present, right? It's not just these streptococcus and villanella that are indigenous to the small bowel and feed on either simple carbs, or villanella actually feeds on lactate produced by other microbes. But they involve bacteria migrating from the large bowel, and those types of bacteria can ferment fiber and resistant starch. So it's also important to include pro-digestion, gut-friendly behaviors that minimize malabsorption, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Now, supplementation may be important based on individual underlying causes. Supplements I often recommend include digestive enzymes that mirror those produced by the pancreas or those released by the microvilli, or even those present in the case of one type of amylase in the saliva. There's also ox bile, vitamins, cofactors, and minerals, gut healing supplements such as zinc carnosine, L-glutamine, probiotics, betaine, HCL. But again, it really depends on what the problem is. My main focus is always improving digestion and minimizing malabsorption, and of course, identifying and addressing underlying conditions wherever possible. Now let's talk about a diet for SIFO. And before we talk about diet, just a quick note. The first step with any fungal illness is to rule out antibiotic use or a compromised immune system. This can occur from drugs, cancer, diabetes, viral infection, et cetera. Addressing these, if present, is critical because fungal overgrowth is more likely to occur in these situations. Now, fungal overgrowth is also more likely to occur when consuming a higher carbohydrate diet. A 2013 study by Hoffman et al., it's linked here, you can read it yourself, showed that intestinal candida species were positively associated with diets higher in carbohydrates, but negatively associated with diets high in amino acids, protein, and fatty acids. So this study, and also the biochemistry of fungi, supports limiting fermentable carbohydrates, particularly simple sugars. Candida albicans, for example, ferments simple sugars such as glucose, maltose, galactose, trehalose, right? That's a big additive for a lot of processed foods and ice cream and so forth. So we want to limit these, as well as sucrose, which breaks down to glucose and fructose. But what about fiber and starch? Fiber and resistant starch may be less of a problem for fungi. However, easy to digest starches, and we call those low FP starches, such as jasmine and sushi rice, and certain potatoes, because they have amylopectin type starch. They're very quickly broken down to glucose and hopefully absorbed before the microbes use them. But if you did have a lot of fungi, you know, say Candida albicans, in your small bowel, in the upper end of your small intestine, where this breakdown is occurring, Candida albicans may very well compete with you, the host, for these glucose molecules as they're being released from starch, from the easier to digest starch. So you may really want to watch the starches, especially the easy to digest starches, at least until you move some of those yeast out from the small bowel. So meanwhile, improving digestion by all means possible, including pro-digestion behaviors, digestive enzymes as well, will help ensure less carbohydrate fuel is available for the yeast to feed on. And at the same time, of course, it goes without saying, working on these underlying, potential underlying causes. All right, how about a diet for LIBO? Well, effective treatment for LIBO really does also involve limiting the five types of fermentable carbohydrates I discussed and employing pro-digestion behaviors, because these will reduce the amount of short-chain fatty acids known to be higher in SIBO and LIBO, increase the colonic pH, right? Two studies show that LIBO produces too much acid and early in the proximal colon. These actions will reduce the amount of Firmicutes type bacteria over Bacteroidetes to make it more like the healthy controls or healthy individuals. These actions will limit Ruminococcus growth. Remember, Ruminococcus species are too high in IBS, and these bacteria specifically feed on resistant starch. And then also, I just want to once again point out that rifaximin wouldn't be something you could take for LIBO because it's just not active in the large intestine. All right, what about IMO? I mean, as many practitioners and people have found, IMO is a challenging condition because methane slows transit, so things aren't moving along, right? So these numbers of organisms can continue to multiply. Also, the methanogens themselves, like Methanobrevibacter smithii, they're quite stable. Now, there are some things that I do think will help. As I mentioned, checking any medicines you're taking and supplements to make sure you're not taking something that's making the constipation worse. Reducing overall fermentable carbohydrates while increasing fats are two important things to do. And by the way, I've linked to a study from 1927, if you can believe it, where a very high fat diet was used effectively to treat constipation. So more fats, more higher protein, higher fat diet, and watch these fermentable carbohydrates. And by the way, there was a study done by a researcher named Ho in 2012 that showed that that people with idiopathic constipation, the constipation was actually worse the more fiber they consumed. So for a lot of people, fiber is not the the best solution. Also take actions to improve digestion and absorption. But one unique thing about IMO, I think, to keep in mind is you should really avoid extreme undereating. Some people, they worry they're constipated, and so they say, I can't even eat because I'm constipated. I'm worried I'll keep filling up and won't go. But you have to be careful there because there's a couple of recent studies on anorexia that showed that anorexics had high methane levels, high levels of methanogens, and were more constipated. So there may be some kind of evolutionary mechanism. If you don't eat much, that your microbes kind of collaborate to get every drop of energy out of fermentable carbohydrates. And producing methane is part of a calorie extraction strategy. Okay. And there's a scientific rationale for reducing the fermentable carbs. First of all, the way I view these methanogens, right, is they are part of a molecular food chain. right? Carbohydrates, either from our diet or from mucus. Remember, mucus that's secreted to protect the lining of our intestines is it consists of about 20 different types of mucin molecules, but they have some things in common. They're very high carbohydrate molecules, or about 80% carbohydrate. They also have sulfate groups on them and amino groups, nitrogen groups. So they're a complete food source for microbes. So even when we don't eat, microbes can feast on the mucus. It's a lock and key, but a lot of the microbes, we talked about Archimensa mucinophila, but there's others can unlock that, the energy in those. And so carbs from our food, carbs from our mucus can feed the bacteria, and they'll make a lot of hydrogen, and that's the food for methanogens. So I'm not surprised that Hoffman study that we had talked about for fungi, they also looked at the methanogens and found the same thing. Methanogens were positively associated with diets high in carbohydrates, but negatively associated with diets high in amino acids, protein, and fatty acids. There's also a link I put here to this David and Turnbull paper in 2014, where they compared diets that were kind of like all animal-based compared to all plant-based. And it was only for about a week people were on these diets, but they did find with an animal-based diet that there was an increase in sulfate-reducing bacteria. Now, some people, those produce hydrogen sulfide. Some people say, well, I don't want too much of that either. But remember, our body, there's a lot of positive things hydrogen sulfide does. Our body also is very good at managing hydrogen sulfide levels. And here's an important point. These sulfate-reducing bacteria compete directly with the methanogens for hydrogen fuel. So, and there's some other things to try here. Digestive enzymes and other supplements to improve digestion. Magnesium citrate is something to try for a less invasive laxative. Other herbals for methanogens, kind of word of mouth. There's some thought that allicin, oregano, neem might be helpful. We really do need better studies to confirm this. And by the way, just not going to the bathroom doesn't necessarily mean you have constipation. If you're not in discomfort or your stools aren't hard and lumpy, on a lower carbohydrate diet, you should keep in mind that you may not need to go as much, since fewer carbs means less fermentation and less fecal mass. One more note I wanted to throw in while we're talking about IMO is a lot of people had high hopes for the statin drug called Sin-10, lovastatin, that showed some inhibitory properties towards methanogens in animal studies and so forth. But that study being done at Cedars-Sinai was in phase 2B mode, and it was just, on my understanding, it was terminated because it didn't meet its primary endpoint. So that's too bad. A lot of people were actually hopeful that drug might work and be safe. Okay, what else you can do? What else can you do? As you realize by now, I do think that people with active dysbiosis should strictly limit fermentable carbohydrates. But as things improve, or for situations where you can't easily avoid carbohydrates, there are some things you might be able to do to improve your digestion, minimize malabsorption, and increase your tolerance. So again, this isn't kind of a license to eat carbohydrates and starches. I really think when you have a lot of symptoms, you should significantly cut back on those across the board, and specifically the high FP ones. But if you get out, say you're at a restaurant, or you can't avoid and you have to have, you know, a few more carbs here and there, these are some things you can do. Eating really slowly, chewing really well. Making sure you're choosing ripe fruits, ripe vegetables. More of the starches are converted to simple sugars. Consuming low FP vegetables and starches. You can cook and peel veggies, lower the FP. Of course, don't do that to all of them. You should eat a few raw, unpeeled veggies to continue to repopulate your gut. Also, for some reason, baked over boiled potatoes are easier to digest. Rice cooked properly, especially if it's the low FP, like jasmine or sushi rice, cooked in, say, a rice cooker with plenty of moisture. So it's kind of light and fluffy, much easier to digest. and avoid refrigerating, avoiding eating leftovers that have been cooled. Even reheated, they'll still have more resistant starch. Leave some breaks between meals and try some fasting. If you have some fat stores, try some fasting, either skipping one or two meals or even a 24-hour or 42-hour fast, something that may really help. And a big one for people on plant-based diets, sprouted grains are much, much lower in FP points than regular grains or legumes, sprouted legumes as well. And we talked about some of these before. Here's some dietary supplements that can help depending on the situation. All right. As I mentioned, plant-based diets tend to contain more fermentable carbohydrates, such as sugars, sugar alcohols, fibers, and resistant starch. But there are some things you can do to limit these and to tolerate them better. If you have some flexibility, by the way, and you can eat some eggs, fish, and seafood, maybe cheese, you know, this helps because it's easier to reduce the fermentable carbohydrates when you're including more kind of go-to proteins and fats. But I do work with many vegetarians, and I found there's still that much can be done even if you don't eat those foods. Controlling dysbiosis on a plant-based diet, I think you can do by focusing on low FP veggies, herbs, nuts and seeds. Don't overdo it on the nuts. And these sprouted legumes. Make sure you're properly supplementing so you're consuming adequate amounts of key vitamins and minerals that are either deficient on a plant-based diet or subject to malabsorption is another problem. So the ones you might look at is vitamin B12, D, A, K2. You could have some natto as a good source of K2. B2 riboflavin, B3 niacin, zinc, iron, calcium, iodine, carnosine, right? Get that from egg yolks, so you're going to need to look for another source or supplement. Taurine and omega-3 fatty acids. Also, some plant-based diets contain too many of these polyunsaturated fatty acids. And what's the worry here? They're easily oxidized and they're inflammatory, and especially the omega-6 fatty acids. So oils like flaxseed, corn, vegetable, peanut, soybean, safflower, probably the worst offenders. But you can get more monounsaturated fatty acids and saturated fatty acids from eating moderate servings of nuts, seeds, nut butters, coconut oil, olive oil, and avocados. Don't overdo it on the avocados because they do have a lot of fiber as well. Maybe a third or a quarter or a third with a meal of an avocado. The behaviors and practices we just covered in the last slide, I think, are even more important on a plant-based diet, as well as diagnosing any digestive enzyme deficiency, including pancreatic or brush border enzyme deficiencies, and supplementing can really help in these cases. Also just controlling SIBO itself, if that's what your diagnosis comes up with, because remember, these bacteria, as they're overgrowing in the small intestine, they're producing a lot of their own digestive enzymes, like proteases, to go after proteins to get their nitrogen sources. Well, if they see the enzymes coming off the tips of your microvilli, they'll chew those up. And so they can really damage your digestion. So I think that's important to first of all, get rid of the SIBO, but also recognize that your digestion is going to be limited. So some people might be losing weight with SIBO and they're all worried about it, and so they eat more and more carbs, but that promotes the growth of more bacteria. So digestion is impacted more. And so in a way, the more calories in the form of carbohydrates you're eating, the worse your absorption of those calories become. So it's kind of like its own problem or cycle. All right, just a reminder here, quantitatively limiting the full spectrum of fermentable carbs is critical. Implement a gut-friendly behavior. Implement gut-friendly behaviors and practices may include supplementing. And don't forget, work with somebody if you need to. I spend a lot of time working with people to go after these underlying potential and contributing underlying causes of dysbiosis. And just a way to connect with us, there's a free ebook on the Fast Track Diet at digestivehealthinstitute.org. Some things I already told you about the diet. There's a free calculator at digestivehealthinstitute.org. You can just Google FP calculator. You'll find a way to get there. And just a reminder, the Fast Track Diet is a kind of a three-pronged approach. All right, again, and some links here. Don't forget, I'd love to have you come and join me in the Fast Track Diet official Facebook group. And there's a couple master classes here as well. And of course, anytime you need some help, feel free to call. Okay. All right, everybody. I know there was a good bit of information there, but I did link to a lot of those studies. If you have the PowerPoint, you can click on those and read more. So until next time, thank you all, and good luck.